The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a story from the Persons of Interest section of the February 20, 2024 online edition of the New Yorker magazine. Vaclav Smil and the Value of Doubt. A ruthless dissector of unwarranted assumptions takes on environmental catastrophists and techno-optimists by David Owen. Not long ago, I randomly opened Vaclav Smil's recent book, Size, How It Explains the World. The first paragraph I read in a chapter about good and bad design concerned rubber flip-flops, which Smil described as among the world's most widely owned individual possessions, even though they provide neither good lateral support nor basic vertical stability. The following paragraph about furniture mentioned the steadily diminishing share of the rich world's population that grows food, catches fish, cuts wood, mines minerals, and builds structures. The next touched on religious pilgrimages, airports, and commuting to work. In 2018, Elizabeth Wilson, who is the founding director of the Arthur L. Irving Institute for Energy and Society at Dartmouth, told Science magazine, "You could take a paragraph from one of his books and make a whole career out of it." Smil is an emeritus professor of environmental studies at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg. He is best known for his writing about global issues, among them energy, agriculture, population, economics, and climate. He has served as a consultant with the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and other institutions. His scholarly interests are eclectic, and he is prolific. Size, which was published last May, is not his most recent book. The second edition of Materials and Dematerialization, which was first published a decade ago as Making the Modern World, came out a month later. Altogether, by his count, he has published 48, beginning with China's Energy Achievements, Problems, Prospects in 1976. He has four more underway, one about globalization, one about food, a size-like study of speed, and a combined reissue by Oxford University Press of two earlier books, which examine the years between 1867 and 1914, the period that he believes did more than any other to shape the modern world. His books typically begin at a trot and maintain the same daydream-defying pace until the final paragraph. The fifth chapter of Size includes a detailed critique with formulas of what he identifies as the impossible proportions of various characters in Gulliver's Travels. Smil writes, "Properly scaled, an adult Lilliputian would thus have a body mass more than 10 times larger than Swift's erroneous attribution, and instead of being equivalent to a tiny shrew, he would be more like an eastern gray squirrel." Smil has a sense of humor, but he uses it sparingly. Even passages that seem at first to be personal or anecdotal sometimes turn out to be footnoted. Smil is a ruthless dissector of what he believes to be unwarranted assumptions, and not just those of 18th century Anglo-Irish satirical novelists. The first book of his that I read 20 years ago was Energy at the Crossroads, published by the MIT Press, in which he wrote that the power under the direct control of an affluent American household, including its vehicles, quote, would have been available only to a Roman latifundia owner of about 6,000 strong slaves, or to a 19th century landlord employing 3,000 workers and 400 big draft horses, end quote. He was making a characteristically vivid point about the impact of modern access to energy, most of it produced by burning fossil fuels. No one can doubt that 21st century American lives are easier, healthier, longer and more mobile than the lives of our ancestors. But Smill's comparison makes it clear that most of us underestimate, by orders of magnitude, the scale of the energy transformations that have made our comforts possible. More recently, Smill has written about ongoing efforts to address climate change and about the feasibility of achieving net zero by 2050. In How the World Really Works, published in 2022, he writes that in the first two decades of the 21st century, despite extensive and expensive expansion of renewable energies, the share of fossil fuels in the world's primary energy supply fell only marginally, from 86% to 82%, and that during the same period, global consumption of fossil fuels actually increased by 45%. Those numbers surprise people whose sense of environmental progress is shaped by car commercials and by news stories about breakthroughs in solar panels, algae-based fuels, and organisms that turn carbon dioxide into stone. They also annoy environmentalists who view Smill's observations as backward-looking and counterproductive, and they contribute to what one journalist described to me recently as Smill's reputation as, quote, a sourpuss, end quote. Smill dislikes giving interviews. He believes that his books contain everything that anyone needs to know about him, and he told me that he had agreed to be profiled in Science Magazine in 2018 only as a favor to his publisher, a gesture he later regretted. When I approached him about this article, I did so with trepidation. We exchanged emails almost daily for most of a month, and we had a lengthy telephone conversation. But when I suggested meeting in person, he replied, "As for flying to Manitoba, nobody ever does that, much like nobody ever flies to Topeka." A quality that runs through all his writing and that I find both appealing and challenging is his stubborn skepticism. Toward the end of How the World Really Works, he quotes a line usually attributed to Descartes that could serve as his own guiding principle. De omnibus dubitandum, doubt everything. Smill was born in 1943 in what today is the Czech Republic, but at the time was the protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia, which the Nazis had established after invading 4 years earlier. He deflected my questions about his upbringing, other than to say that his childhood, if a label has to be chosen, was normal and happy. Between 1960 and 1965, he was a student at Charles University in Prague. He described his student years and the ones immediately following them as a long prelude to the Prague Spring of 1968. The Prague Spring was a period of liberalization that began with Alexander Dubček's election as the head of the country's Communist Party on January 5th, and ended 7.5 months later with a full-scale invasion by Soviet bloc soldiers and tanks. Until the Soviets intervened, Smill said, even ordinary students could access Western papers and journals in the university library. He studied a broad range of topics related to energy, among them biology, geology, meteorology, demography, economics, and statistics. The subject of his undergraduate thesis was the environmental impacts of coal-fired electricity generation, particularly the effects of air pollution. His scholarly skepticism, he said, came to him naturally, beginning when he was a teenager, and was mightily reinforced by getting trained as an old-fashioned scientist in what the Germans call in one of their beloved compounds, Naturwissenschaften, beholden to demonstrable realities, strengthened daily by living until 1969 under the commies with their endless lies about everything. Smill met his wife while both were students, she in medical school. Like thousands of other Czechs, they fled the country before travel restrictions made immigration virtually impossible. They arrived in the United States on August 31st, 1969, and he spent 2 years earning a doctorate in the geography department at Penn State. The subject of his dissertation was global energy development. In 1972, the University of Manitoba offered him a job, and he took it. He is fluent in four languages and has studied half a dozen others. His recent reading, he told me, has included Mandelstam and Pasternak in Russian and the New Testament in Latin. His English is excellent, but accented, and he speaks it even faster than he writes. So fast that there were parts of our telephone conversation that I didn't understand until I had listened to a recording with the speed reduced by 25%. A dozen years ago, I interviewed a highly regarded chemistry professor at a major American university. He surprised me by saying that his job forced him to spend so much time traveling that he had the same better-than-first-class status on American Airlines that the character played by George Clooney has in the 2009 movie Up in the Air. He needed to travel, he explained, because in many ways the most important and time-consuming part of his job was soliciting funding all over the world for the research that his graduate students performed in his lab. When I mentioned this to Smill, he said that what I had described was the modern ideal of the scientist, just flying around and drumming up monies, and that he detested it. He has never relied on grad students. I used to run madly among libraries, he said, but now he makes heavy use of online resources, among them the Web of Science, to which the university still gives him access, and Gallica, a multi-century digital archive created by the National Library of France. He loves classical music, but is absolutely tone-deaf and plays no instruments. He has a good memory for big numbers and can do many calculations in his head. His ideas come to him, he said, when he walks, reads, wakes up in the morning, sits on airplanes, or cooks, including favorite Japanese dishes. He began visiting Japan in 1978 and co-wrote a book about the evolution of the modern Japanese diet. I just write my books, much as a plumber fixes pipes and garbage men haul away junk, he said. I mean it, no introspection. It's just kind of a work I like and can do. Smill has written a great deal about renewable energy technologies. And he has said that their implementation cannot contribute to grow quickly enough to fully negate the global increase in overall energy demand during the next two or three decades. Unrealistic expectations for such technologies, he has written, arise in part from inappropriate extrapolation from the extraordinarily fast and sustained evolution of solid-state electronics, beginning roughly 75 years ago with the invention of the transistor. In 1965, Gordon Moore, later a co-founder of Intel, observed that the number of components that could be etched on a single microchip doubled roughly every 2 years. The number of such components grew from a few thousand in the 1970s to tens of billions today, a phenomenon that's often referred to as Moore's Law. Even for microchips, that rate may be slackening, but its application in most other areas has always been problematic. In his book, Invention and Innovation, which MIT published last year, Smill writes, "We are told that rapid exponential growth driven by digitization and advances in AI already prevails in such fields as solar cells, batteries, electric cars, and even urban farming. Such growth, where it actually does exist, can't continue permanently," he argues. Belief that it can, in his view, is consistent with what he described to me as Americans' Barnumian approach to science and innovation, where every dubious claim is treated as transformative change, and where every patently impossible promise, nuclear fusion, high-temperature superconductivity, the colonization of Mars, is worshipped as another effusion of history's most brilliant minds. In his book, Growth, which MIT published, in 2019, Smil takes the same expansive approach to his subject that he does in size. The subtitle is From Microorganisms to Megacities. But he does so in smaller type and at almost double the page count. In a brief review in Foreign Policy, Keith Johnson wrote that the best way to appreciate Vaclav Smil's latest doorstopper is to take a deep breath, walk across the room, and pick up the book from wherever it landed after being tossed away for the umpteenth time as impenetrable, incomprehensible mush. But Johnson did pick it up, and in the next paragraph of his review, he describes growth as fascinating, compelling, and ultimately convincing. In the book's preface, Smil writes that most growth processes of organisms, artifacts, or complex systems can be plotted on a so-called S-shaped or sigmoid growth curve, meaning that the rate of change increases slowly at first and then increases rapidly, but then levels off. An error that humans make with similarly predictable regularity is to assume that the nearly vertical middle segment of an S-shaped curve can continue at that angle indefinitely. The price of Dutch tulips in the 17th century, the price of Bitcoin in the 21st. One of his conclusions is that the steady, unceasing economic expansion that economists and politicians dream of is not sustainable, and that the relentless pursuit of growth is environmentally disastrous. Smil has often said that he doesn't make forecasts, a pathetically and inexorably ever-failing endeavor on any level, he told me. But predictions of a kind are implicit in much of his work. In Growth's Coda, he writes, continuous material growth based on ever greater extraction of the Earth's inorganic and organic resources and on increased degradation of the biospheres, finite stocks and services is impossible. A principle that in various forms animates almost all his work, beginning with his undergraduate thesis. This framework explains why Smil is deeply skeptical about what he views as unrealistic climate goals. He writes, the predilection of grand global meetings as well as of national strategies to set decarbonization targets at years ending in zero or five, 45% less carbon by 2030 globally, no carbon emissions from U.S. electricity generation by 2035, net zero carbon globally by 2050, is an obviously arbitrary exercise, and meeting these goals would require extraordinary technical and economic transformation on the global scale. A transformation that the world ultimately must make, he believes, but that cannot be achieved within the time frames now commonly predicted for it. The multinational agreement that was reached in December at COP28, the 28th Annual Climate Change Conference, conducted by the United Nations, has been described as mildly encouraging. But viewing its adoption as a watershed moment requires an heroic suspension of disbelief. And not only because the United Arab Emirates, which hosted the meeting, has almost tripled its electricity consumption since 2000 and still produces by far the largest proportion of it by burning natural gas and oil. There are other reasons for skepticism. Norway is often cited as a global role model because it generates the vast majority of its electricity hydroelectrically. But Norway is an unusual case. It has a small population and an abundance of dammable rivers, and its economy still depends, as it has for decades, on exports of oil and natural gas, revenues from which have enabled it, among other things, to deeply subsidize its citizens' electric vehicles. Australia, similarly, has significantly increased its clean energy infrastructure, But since the early 90s, it has also more than doubled its production of coal, much of which it exports to China. China, in turn, both produces and burns more coal than any other country in the world, and has partly achieved its extraordinary economic growth, Smil told me, by quadrupling its combustion of fossil carbon. In the United States, electricity production by wind and solar has grown in recent years, and dependence on coal has fallen. But we burn so much more natural gas than we used to that our total consumption of fossil fuels remains close to what it was 25 years ago. The recent slowing of China's rate of industrialization, S-shaped curves eventually flatten, has not ended its reliance on fossil fuels. The Chinese are still building new coal-fired power plants at the rate of roughly 2 a week. Not that long ago, Beijing was still a city of bicycles. Today, it's plagued by air pollution, much of it produced by cars. China is the world's leader in the manufacture of electric vehicles, but it's also the world's leader in generating electricity by burning coal. India's road network, which is already the world's second longest after ours, is growing rapidly. China's energy consumption will likely peak before 2030, Smil said, but India, Pakistan, Indonesia, and countries in sub-Saharan Africa, among others, are already aiming to follow its growth example. Don't forget that at least 2.5 billion people around the world still burn wood and straw and even dried dung for everyday activities. The same fuels that people burned 2,000 years ago, he continued. For many years to come, he added, economic growth in such places will necessarily be powered primarily by coal, oil, and natural gas. They will do what we have done, and what China has done, and what India is trying to do now, he said. The rate at which the world decarbonizes, he continued, will be determined by them, not by us. Last May, Smil gave an interview to a writer from California Energy Markets, a news outlet for that state's primary energy suppliers and buyers. His book, Innovation and Innovation, had just been published. The headline was, No Easy Solutions for Climate Change, scientist Vaclav Smil says. A particular challenge in the transition away from fossil fuels, he told the writer, is the scarcity of interconnected long-distance electricity transmission infrastructure. This is an issue that is older than any effort to deal with climate change, but one consequence of it is that moving electricity from places where wind and sunshine are plentiful to places where they are not is often infeasible. This is not only a U.S. problem, he said. Canada has no national grid, and even the much more densely populated European Union does not have sufficient connections to bring electricity generation by large wind projects in the North Sea southward. In the same interview, he said, the most immediate way to lower carbon emissions is to shut down all coal-fired plants. Theoretically fine, but practically impossible. And even if the U.S. were to do so immediately, China and India will not. The day after that interview appeared online, David Roberts, who produces a podcast called Volts, V-O-L-T-S, posted a link on the site X and commented, This dude gets more useless and irrelevant with each passing day, and it clearly offends his ego. Smil has never posted anything on social media, but he mentioned Robert's tweet to me and was clearly bothered by it. In an email, he told me, A few months ago, a guy with an undergrad degree in philosophy wrote that I know absolutely nothing about energy, not even the basic physics. Robert's philosophy degree is actually a master's. His undergraduate degree was in English. But his podcast is well regarded, and his library of episodes includes substantive interviews with many prominent environmentalists, climate scientists, and entrepreneurs. Roberts and I spoke on the phone, and he told me that he hadn't actually read much of Smil's work, and that most of what he knew about him and his books were based on other people's characterizations. He said that his impression was that Smil enjoyed being the hard-headed, realistic one and bringing down other people's silly dreams and fantasies. I asked him if he felt that the difference in outlook was age-related. Smil is 3 decades older than Roberts. He said that he thought there was definitely a generational piece, but that at every age level there exists a whole family of commentators who spend their days yelling at green activists for being unrealistic. The antipathy that some environmentalists feel toward Smil may be partly a result of intellectual company he has sometimes been willing to keep. His 2010 book, Energy, Myths, and Realities, was published not by MIT or Oxford, but by the American Enterprise Institute, a think tank whose public positions, even today, include deep skepticism about climate change. The book received a dust jacket blurb from Robert Bradley, a former Enron executive and the CEO of the Institute for Energy Research, which was co-founded by Charles Koch and has been tagged by Greenpeace as a promoter of debunked scientific studies on a long list of environmental topics. From Bradley's blurb, which stated, Smil combines basic economics, technological understanding, and historical insight to skewer false energy visions. Energy reality, he reminds us, is determined by the free marketplace, not by words or wishes. End quote. This isn't false, but given Bradley's climate agenda, it's misleading. Smil told me that he had published the book with the AEI because an editor he had written essays for elsewhere had taken a job there. But it's also like him to dismiss what he thinks of as lazy accusations of guilt by association. In his view, scientific facts are scientific facts, no matter who puts them in print. In an email, he told me, I have never belonged to any political party. I am a lifelong solo sailor, and I am appalled at the level of incivility and mad partisanship to which the U.S. discourse has deteriorated. After all, enterprise has built America, but is it now detestable to publish a factual text with an institution devoted to its promotion? The Inflation Reduction Act, which Congress passed in 2022, is by far the U.S. government's most ambitious effort to address climate change, and it does so largely by creating tax credits and other incentives intended to hasten this country's transition from fossil fuels. The IRA, notably, is not a call for cutting back. Lee Stokes, a professor of environmental politics at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and a significant contributor to the drafting, passage, and implementation of the act, has said in an interview, "The things we're talking about are not about sacrifice. They're actually about abundance. They're about creating a cooler, more exciting, and better future." The future that Stokes envisions will be built on heat pumps, solar panels, and the electrification of everything, everywhere. Saul Griffith, an Australian-American engineer, has also been deeply involved in the IRA. I wrote about Griffin in this magazine in 2010. Griffith is a co-founder of Rewiring America, an organization for which Stokes is the senior policy counsel, and he is the author of Electrify, an optimist playbook for our clean energy future, which MIT published in 2021. Once we've electrified, he writes in that book, our citizens can keep pretty much all of the complexity and variety promised by the American dream with the same sized homes and vehicles while using less than half the energy we currently use. All this might be thought of as the anti-Smil position. Stokes and Griffith have both been interviewed at length on the book Volts. And the case that they, Roberts, and like-minded climate thinkers make is that the world's transition to renewables has reached a critical threshold and that we won't have to deprive ourselves of first-world luxuries in order to reach the ultimate goal. But there are reasonable questions. One is whether enough of us can be counted on to think and act as logically as college professors and engineers, even with tax breaks dangled in front of us. For centuries, humans have routinely converted improvements in efficiency into increases in consumption. In an email, Smil told me that in terms of per capita energy use in the United States, there is no indication that many kinds of better efficiencies have combined to bring any notable savings. The average American used 285 gigajoules of energy in 2012, he said, and 284 gigajoules in 2022, despite significant efficiency gains in every category. And our record would look worse if, during the past few decades, American companies hadn't shifted so much manufacturing to fossil fuel-powered factories in Asia. This dilemma is easy to see on American roads. The best-selling vehicles in the United States last year were Ford F-Series pickup trucks, which for many drivers have taken the place of station wagons. As has often been observed, many models get roughly the same number of miles per gallon as the Ford Model T, which was first manufactured in 1908. But the reason is not that modern engines are inefficient. On the contrary, they're so remarkably efficient that they now power vehicles that weigh multiples of what the Model T did, despite being loaded with power-hungry features and requiring comparatively little maintenance. In all our vehicles, no matter how they're powered, improvements in energy efficiency often result in increases in curb weight. A Tesla Cybertruck weighs more than 3 tons. An all-electric GMC Hummer EV's battery pack alone weighs almost a ton and a half, or roughly 800 pounds more than an entire Mitsubishi Mirage. Manufacturing those vehicles is energy and raw material intensive, and it has devastating environmental impacts beyond adding to the atmosphere's carbon load. And the taste for ever larger vehicles isn't just an American foible. Until the 1960s, Smil writes in his book Growth, both European and Japanese cars weighed much less than U.S. vehicles. But since the 1970s, their average masses have shown a similarly increasing trend. If you've driven a full-size rental car in Europe in recent years, you may have noticed that the dimensions of European parking spaces have not kept up. Net zero is a target that doesn't stay put. Even to raise issues like this is to risk being labeled a climate change sourpuss. But questioning strategies is not the same as questioning objectives. In an adaptation from his book, How the World Really Works, published by Yale Environment 360 in 2022, Smil wrote, "The problem is that rather than take a clear-eyed look at the enormous challenges of phasing out fossil fuels that are the basis of modern industrial economies, we have ricocheted between catastrophism on the one hand and the magical thinking of techno-optimism on the other." Smil has described himself as neither an optimist nor a pessimist, but merely as someone who presents correct statistics and engineering realities. Yet, he also told me that upholding rationality in an utterly mad world leads nowhere, and that he sees no point in throwing more dry peas against the wall of ignorance and self-satisfied but grossly misinformed greenness. Whether that strikes you as a good thing or a bad thing may depend, at least in part, on how you feel about the value of doubt. Thus far, the world has mostly failed to meet even relatively unambitious climate goals. Is that about to change? In a podcast in 2021, David Roberts said that one reason he believes the abandonment of fossil fuels will move faster than skeptics like Smil think is that the change is not merely a transition from one set of physical energy sources to another, though it is that too, but it is also partly a transition from the physical to the digital. That is the techno-optimist position. If it's correct, we have nothing to worry about. But what if it's not? And now, from the daily comments section of the October 31st, 2023 issue of the New Yorker, a smoking gun for Biden's big climate decision. A new analysis suggests that LNG exports may well be worse for the environment than burning coal, by Bill McKibben. The Biden administration faces one of its most profound climate choices this autumn. Should it continue to allow the expansion of liquefied natural gas exports, or should it halt the rapid build-out of the industry at least until it can come up with new guidelines? The stakes are enormous. The build-out of liquefied natural gas infrastructure in the United States is by far the largest example of fossil fuel expansion currently proposed anywhere in the world. But there's some new data that may make the administration's choice easier, or certainly starker. The data are from an analysis by Robert Warren Howarth, a professor of ecology and environmental biology at Cornell, who is one of the world's premier methane scientists. The analysis attempts to establish the greenhouse gas footprint of liquefied natural gas exported to Europe and Asia, and the numbers presented are astonishing. Coal-fired power has long been the standard for measuring climate change. When burned, coal releases carbon dioxide into the air in large quantities. In recent years, Howarth has demonstrated that domestically, natural gas is no better for the climate than coal, largely owing to the methane leaks associated with it. Now, though, it appears that exporting liquefied natural gas, because of the extra leakage of the supercooled gas during transit, could allow even larger amounts of methane to escape into the atmosphere and, hence, could do much more damage to the climate than coal does. The leaks come at every stage of the process, Howarth explains. Even once the gas is compressed aboard ship in insulated tanks, some of it boils off as heat leaks through the insulation. Newer tankers try to burn that boiled-off methane for fuel, but even then, Howarth says, some of it is emitted unburned in the exhaust stream. He notes it all adds up. Howarth models a number of different scenarios, varying for how far the liquefied natural gas travels and how much methane might be released. According to his calculations, even when the gas is delivered with the most modern ship taking the most direct route, the greenhouse gas emissions from the entire ground-to-combustion life cycle of liquefied natural gas, from the fracking wells to the pipelines, the liquefaction stations, the ships, and the final combustion, are 24% worse than those caused by digging up and burning an equivalent amount of coal. The worst cases, long voyages in old vessels burning lots of oil, show an impact 274% worse. Howarth, however, is careful to point out that, though his paper has been submitted to a peer-reviewed journal, the review process has not yet been completed. "It's always possible I may have made a mistake or two," he told me. "Hopefully not large." But assuming that the thrust of the data stands, it undercuts the liquefied natural gas proponent's key argument that at least it's cleaner than coal. Howarth concludes his paper by saying that ending the use of liquefied natural gas must be a global priority. As I wrote earlier this year, liquefied natural gas exportation is relatively new for the United States. The first big cargoes didn't leave facilities on the Gulf Coast, close to the Permian Basin in Texas, one of the largest repositories of gas in the world, until 2016. But the industry has grown rapidly, and the U.S. is now the largest exporter of natural gas in the world. So far, 7 big export terminals have been built, most of them along the Gulf Coast, and at least 20 more are planned. According to the energy consultant and former Environmental Protection Agency climate policy advisor Jeremy Simons, if all of them are built, they will be associated with an extra 3.2 billion tons of greenhouse gas emissions annually, which is close to the entire annual emissions of the European Union from every car and house and factory from the northernmost Finnish village to the southernmost Greek isle. It's an unbelievable amount of pollution, and it would spell game over for a livable planet as we've known it, Simons recently told The Guardian. Faced with such findings, the industry has fallen back on claims about relative as opposed to absolute emissions. After my previous piece appeared, a spokesperson for Venture Global, the company behind the largest of the proposed export terminals on the Gulf, said that the well-funded environmental activists opposing CP2 and all U.S. liquefied natural gas projects are completely out of touch with reality. She added, ironically, Mr. McKibben and other activists who claim to want to lower global emissions are actually advocating for restricting access to a cleaner form of energy and denying energy security to millions of people. This would only result in continued and increased coal use and prevent the reduction of global emissions. Laying aside the well-funded part, I have always worked as a volunteer at Third Act and 350.org, the two climate organizations I founded, and taken together, their budgets are a tiny fraction of the billions of dollars in revenues these gas exports bring in annually. The reality, according to Howard's paper, is that liquefied natural gas sends global emissions up, even compared with coal. Howarth goes as far as to say that short-term energy needs, in an emergency such as the invasion of Ukraine, are better met by reopening closed coal facilities on a temporary basis than by expanding liquefied natural gas infrastructure. The fact that this analysis comes from Howarth is key, because he's been proved right over and over again. He and two colleagues then at Cornell, Anthony Ingrafia and Rene Santoro, began researching the climate implications of methane emissions from oil and gas production in 2009, and a year later they started publishing their findings in scientific journals. At that time, fracked natural gas was widely regarded as a solution to the climate crisis. In several State of the Union messages, President Barack Obama lauded the spread of fracking, and his State Department set up a special bureau that spread the technology abroad. Obama said in 2013, "The natural gas boom has led to cleaner power and greater energy independence. We need to encourage that, and that's why my administration will keep cutting red tape and speeding up new oil and gas permits." Even environmentalists agreed. The then executive director of the Sierra Club toured the country with the head of one of the largest fracking firms, praising the new technology. The Sierra Club has since become a staunch opponent of natural gas expansion. That support was based on the fact that when you burn natural gas in a power plant, it produces half as much carbon dioxide as burning coal does. So, if the goal was simply to drive down carbon dioxide emissions, Replacing coal with natural gas would perhaps have been the bridge to a renewable future that proponents claimed. The problem is that the other prime culprit in global warming is methane, CH4, which so far is responsible for as much as 40% of global warming, and natural gas is mostly methane. Early work by Howarth and his team established that it was likely that methane was leaked especially from explosively fracking shale rock to get at the gas, and that the damage from those escaping molecules likely outweighed the benefit that came from switching off coal. Additional research by more scientists suggested that the break-even point at which gas became worse than coal was a leak rate somewhere around 2 or 3%. Those findings were not readily welcomed. As Obama's former Energy Secretary Stephen Chu said in 2013, there was a very famous Cornell report which we looked at and decided it was not as credible as it, well, we didn't think it was credible. I'll just put it that way. Year after year, however, new data collected from overflights of fracking fields, patrols of urban pipelines, and, most recently, satellite measurements, confirmed the Cornell data. Leakage rates were high enough to make natural gas unnaturally dangerous. By 2016, a Harvard team had published satellite data showing that methane emissions in the U.S. had spiked 30% since 2002. A period that almost perfectly coincided with the advent of fracking for gas. During the Trump administration, even federal efforts to slow down leaks, such as by tightening operations at wellheads and pumping stations, were largely abandoned. Those efforts have resumed under President Biden, and the big fossil fuel players have continued to bet on a fracked gas future. Earlier this month, ExxonMobil bought Pioneer Energy, one of the largest frackers in the Permian Basin. But the biggest boom has been in exports, especially since Russia went to war in Ukraine. And that's where Howarth's data hits so hard. They join other data that have emerged in the past few weeks. A new working paper from a team led by Douglas Almond, an economist at Columbia University, shows that satellites can now pick up a methane bloom when liquefied natural gas carriers unload in European ports. Howarth, though, in his usual cautious fashion, thinks that the actual amount of leakage during offloading may be small and does not include it in his analysis. And the climate folly of building new fossil fuel infrastructure has been highlighted for Gulf residents by this month's global warming problem. The dwindling flow of a drought-plagued Mississippi is letting salt water well up the river, threatening local drinking water supplies. So the pressure on the administration continues to grow. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is the first stop for permit applications for these new terminals, has so far been more of a rubber stamp. Earlier this month, it approved a plan to dramatically increase the flow of fracked gas through one of Venture Global's facilities and also a big fracked gas pipeline in the Pacific Northwest. But after the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the next player is the Department of Energy. It cannot deny permits for the facilities, but it can deny the export licenses needed to make them profitable. Without such a license, companies would be able to sell only to Mexico, Canada, and a handful of other countries with which we have free trade agreements. In order to do so, the Department of Energy needs to conclude that the projects would be in the public interest, which it has been doing using guidelines developed under the Trump administration, on the ground that liquefied natural gas would do less climate damage. If Howarth's findings are correct, the administration needs to establish new guidelines. The industry would naturally resist new guidelines, and Republicans in Congress have moved to strip away the public interest standard entirely. But the Biden administration may find new support for such a step in yet another new report, this one from Tyson Slocum, a public citizen, which concludes that the dramatic flood of liquefied natural gas exports authorized by the Department of Energy in recent years is upending domestic energy markets, directly contributing to punishingly high energy prices for Americans, thereby exacerbating energy poverty and income inequality for the most vulnerable in our communities. Using new government data, Slocum estimates that the cost to American consumers would top $14 billion by 2050. It remains to be seen whether Howler's findings and other recent reports, not to mention 2023's record temperatures, might lead the Biden administration to stop new approvals for more plants until it can redefine the public interest. Its actions in the weeks ahead could begin to repair some of the political rift opened by the president's approval of the Willow Oil Complex earlier this year, or they could deepen the sense of many young people that we remain on a glide path to yet more catastrophic warming. Next, from the November 5th, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Can Seawalls Save Us? Huge coastal barriers could protect the world's cities, but they'll have unexpected costs, by Daniel A. Gross. Hard seawalls may be the bluntest instrument in coastal engineering. Typically, they are made from concrete, stone, wood, or metal and rise vertically from the shore. But a wave that strikes a seawall never breaks and dissipates as it would on a beach. Instead, it bounces off like an echo, its destructive force intact. In the end, the flow of water and sediment is a zero-sum game. For a wave to spare one place, it has to strike another. For sand to accumulate somewhere, it has to wash away from somewhere else. According to the sociologist Summer Gray, seawalls are less a practical solution than a product of technocratic ideology, one that colonial powers have exported around the world. For all their potential benefits, seawalls harm the environment, shift vulnerability downstream, lead to the disappearance of the beach, and create cycles of dependency, she writes in her new book, In the Shadow of the Seawall. Dr. Rachel Gitman, a marine ecologist at East Carolina University, offered another reason to worry about seawalls. Natural habitats already serve as powerful buffers against flooding, she said. They absorb water and energy. This is why marsh and mangrove restoration is often the best way to protect a coast. By contrast, when coastal communities wall off the shoreline, they tend to trap ecosystems between the water and the wall, causing a process called coastal squeeze. It can be a slow drowning of those habitats, she told me. When they disappear, we may be more vulnerable than when we started. Coastal protection is usually treated as a cost and benefit problem. The more people and property in a given place, the greater a seawall's benefits. Last year, when the Army Corps of Engineers proposed a vast network of seawalls and gates to shield New York and New Jersey Harbor, it argued that the $53 billion project was a very good deal. Although it will not totally eliminate flood risks in the area, it would cost much less than repairing the city after every storm. Hurricane Sandy caused an estimated $19 billion in damage in New York City alone. The densest, wealthiest, and most vulnerable coastal cities, Bangkok, Shanghai, Rio de Janeiro, San Francisco, Miami, are likely to make similar calculations. Yes, a seawall may erode the shore and draw even more people toward the water, but lives and livelihoods are already concentrated there. If a seawall could save them, don't we have to build one? The opposite presumably will be true in rural and ecologically fragile places. A seawall might endanger too many species or wash away too many beaches or simply protect too little to justify the cost. Such calculations, however, leave a lot out. Industrialized societies have never been good at valuing the non-human or the intangible benefits. The cost-benefit equation doesn't account for moral hazard either. Seawalls are supposed to shield us from risk, but if they draw people and property to the shore, they might wind up exposing more of us to it. Money also tends to protect money. Do we want to live in a world where only the wealthy can afford seawalls and everyone else must retreat or risk drowning? If our math is wrong, what could right it? In an era of rising seas, we are primed to think of coastal protections as prudent. Given their unintended consequences, however, we should be wary of the risk and skeptical of their benefits. Instead of building as many walls as we can, we should build as few as we need to, and only when they protect what matters most. This last notion of what matters most is a question, not an answer. Seawalls are expensive, and unfairness will be one of their heaviest costs. In theory, a moratorium on residential seawalls is itself a kind of coastal squeeze meant to encourage relocation. This is a complicated position to take, but it reflects a complicated reality. On a windy evening in August, I biked to a park in Lower Manhattan to meet Yuki Miura, a soft-spoken researcher who has modeled the flooding that a hurricane would inflict on Manhattan. I asked her whether instead of building walls that could anchor people along the coast, New Yorkers should think about moving away from the shore. Managed retreat might be a good option in different regions, she told me. It's very hard to imagine here. Manhattan is home to 1.6 million people and trillions of dollars of coastal infrastructure. Once you've built skyscrapers and hospitals and highways along the water, just a few feet above sea level, it's hard to imagine any path into the future that leaves so much of value behind. I thought about all of the choices that had led to this moment. We are fortifying the shore in part because we burn fossil fuels. We burn fossil fuels because we believe that some other place or some other later generation would bear the consequences. In this sense, the story of seawalls and their downsides mirrors the larger story of the climate crisis. We need to solve the problem from the bottom, Miura told me. Until we do the hard, collective work of slashing emissions, the planet will keep getting hotter, the water will keep rising, and the storms will keep getting worse. As the sun set, we looked out across the water. The clouds were turning purple and orange. A few boats drifted by. It was easy to understand why someone would want to live here. Then my eyes came to rest on the apartment blocks and factories that dotted the Queens waterfront, an area that is as densely populated as parts of Manhattan, but where no comparable seawalls have been built. I asked Miura what would happen there. Could the water that would have flooded Manhattan instead end up somewhere else, like Queens? It will be shifted, yeah, Miura told me. Water has to go somewhere. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.